pages I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding in the damp fog.
You're listening to episode 561 of Unwelcome Guests. $100 million to crack a lone nut. I'm Robin Upton. This week on the show, we're looking at an often neglected part of the September the 11th drama, the anthrax attacks, which were launched on opposition to the Patriot Act in the weeks following. Initially, of course, the anthrax was mailed with some crude Islamic-style text to suggest a close connection between the attacks of September the 11th, of course immediately fingered as Islamic terrorists' work, and the later anthrax. Now, with that in mind, it's intriguing that, according to their own investigation, the anthrax turned out to be a fake Islamic terrorist. The FBI, after spending $100 million to investigate, has come up with a report which blames it not on a conspiracy, but the work of a lone nut, who conveniently is unavailable for comment or investigation, having possibly committed suicide, certainly found dead. We're going to be looking into more details of the anthrax case in a second hour, and towards the end of the first hour, we're going to first set the scene by looking at the formula of state-sponsored terror, state crimes against democracy, they have been called, and noting that the lone nut is a fallback position if the original case that it's wicked foreign terrorists is looking too flimsy for anybody to believe. And now let's start with a short but valuable section by Mark Crispin Miller. This is from the introduction to the Investigate Building 7 conference at the University of Hartford in March this year.
I think it's abundantly clear that the NIST study leaves a lot to be desired, and that there's copious and specific evidence that the official explanation for 9/11 in general, and Building 7 in particular, is, well, it strains credulity. But the question is, how come when there's so much evidence that cries out for a new investigation, which after all is what we want, how come when there's so much evidence, there seems to be no journalistic response? There's no reporting on this important story. In fact, the more evidence there is, it seems, the less likely any kind of coverage, the more resistant journalists tend to become, and that's not just mainstream journalists, but even on the left as well. Well, there's nothing really particularly unusual about this problem. In other words, the journalistic silence on the vast body of evidence vis-a-vis Building 7, for example, is not unusual. It's something that we've seen repeatedly over the last 50 or 60 years. The reason why you get no journalistic hearing despite all that evidence is that this notion that the official report is faulty is a conspiracy theory, right? And you are all conspiracy theorists, and you've heard a lot of conspiracy theory here. That's the phrase you run into again and again and again and again. So this is the problem that the panel's going to discuss. And I'm going to introduce the other panelists as soon as I make just a couple of very basic points, and they don't require any background in engineering, okay? I think the engineers here will enjoy them, however, or appreciate them, I should say. First of all, the idea that there might be some kind of an elite conspiracy was once upon a time in this nation's history a given. I mean, if you read widely in the work of the framers, you see that the possibility that their young Republican experiment might be undone by an elite conspiracy was always on their minds. They were preoccupied with this, that the British Empire and its agents and its sympathizers in the United States might do everything they could conspiratorially to destroy this experiment in Republican self-government. This is, you know, just read what they had to say about Aaron Burr, for example. Elite conspiracy was not a crackpot idea, you see, but common sense. So it's important to understand that, that this allergy that we have all developed to anything that smacks of conspiracy theory, where we make the sign of the cross and hold ourselves away, you know, this is fairly recent. And it is particularly germane, I think, to note that it was not commonplace in journalistic discourse until the late 60s. It was not until some authors began to question the findings of the Warren Commission that journalists began to use the phrase conspiracy theory, or I should say that the phrase conspiracy theory became current, and it really never stopped being current. We've seen it repeatedly ever since, particularly from 1980 on. And I can suggest that you dig up a declassified CIA memo from April 1st, 1967 that deals with the problem of these authors. This is Mark Lane and Edward J. Epstein had written books questioning the results of the Warren Commission. The CIA said, this is a problem. Our solution is to use our, this is a quote, propaganda assets and friends in the media to discredit the work of these conspiracy theorists by using the following five arguments. You know, and then there are arguments we keep hearing today, like if there were such a big conspiracy, someone would have talked, something like that. The point is that there it is, it's in black and white, the CIA is suggesting that the media be used to cast aspersions on what were, after all, entirely reasonable questions about the official explanation of the Kennedy assassination. Okay? Well, if you search the phrase conspiracy theory in the archives of the New York Times or Time magazine, it'll take you a few seconds, you see that before the late 60s, the phrase was very, very rarely used. And then after the late 60s, it's used again and again and again and again. I would suggest that if you want to get anywhere with this issue, okay, you cannot keep simply trying to push the evidence on journalists. At the same time, you have to raise a more fundamental question, which is, what do we mean when we say something's a conspiracy theory, right? And why is it self-evident that conspiracies are impossible? Conspiracies against democracy. Why are they any more unlikely now than they were back in 1787? Okay? So the fact is, there have been many stories since the 60s that have been treated in exactly this way, stories in which the evidence is overwhelming, which the case has actually been made, and yet somehow that story gets dismissed as a conspiracy theory. I don't need to see the evidence. I know it's conspiracy theory because it's unlikely, because it's something I'd rather not believe.
And that is one of the key questions of our time, I think. How soon can we grasp reality rather than very long-nurtured illusion? I won't dwell on that. I think if you're a blue pillar, you're probably not even listening to the show. So now we're going to hear Tony Gosling and Martin Summers' production. This is from the State of the City Reports series by the Bristol Broadband Cooperative. Very much appreciate the work that you do, guys. I found this on radioforall.net a couple of weeks ago.
A false flag terror attack is when the group, country or political faction blamed for a bomb or other outrage are actually the enemy of the people who actually carried it out. It's rather like the grisly phenomenon of self-harming. The aim is simple: to make an aggressor look like a victim and the victim look like the aggressor. One telltale sign of this is when there's a very quick revelation as to who's behind an attack, like on 9/11 and 7/7, when Bush and Blair respectively announced on the day of the attacks that Islamic factions were likely to be behind it all. But NATO has a disturbing track record of this kind of cowardly attack. It's called Operation Gladio, and it was supposed to be the most secret operation NATO ever carried out. But some of those tasked to carry out these attacks were so disgusted with what they'd been ordered to do that they blew the whistle. Swiss historian Daniel Ganser and I spoke to him recently about the topic of his book, because he's done thorough research on the subject, starting in London. His book is called NATO's Secret Armies.
Historian researching international politics and economic affairs of the last 60 years. I teach at Basel University in Switzerland, and my book, NATO's Secret Armies, Operation Gladio and Terrorism in Western Europe, deals with secret warfare in Western Europe during the Cold War. In Italy, the secret army was named Gladio. So many people know of the whole story with that keyword Gladio, because if you type in Gladio on the internet, that's really the keyword that brings you to these secret armies. And it was the name of the Stay Behind army of NATO in Italy, and it was discovered in 1990, so that's already 20 years ago. A Stay Behind army is a secret network of soldiers who waits until an invasion has actually happened and until a country is occupied. So it stays behind enemy lines and has arms caches across the country, and then fights the occupying powers. So it's sort of special forces who operate behind enemy lines. The important thing to understand is that the secret armies had two purposes. First, they were to be ready in case of the Soviet invasion. I mean, if you think back the Cold War, we always had this fear in Western Europe that the Soviet Union would invade and occupy Western Europe. So British and American soldiers and generals planned for that event and therefore set up secret armies. But they were not only fearing a Soviet invasion, they were also fearing communist parties who were active in democracies of Western Europe quite in peacetime, you know. And so some of the terrorist attacks that were carried out in Italy seemed to be linked to right-wing terrorists who carried out these attacks with support of the secret armies and then blamed them on the Italian communists and the socialists just to discredit the left. I mean, that is called false flag terrorism, and it works.
Why should you really fear a communist party if that communist party, as in Italy, for example, is democratically elected and that's what the people want?
Because the communist party in Italy, you know, they were very strong in parliament. They had some 30% of the vote. At some point, you know, if you're strong in the legislative branch, you want to have minister positions. So you want maybe to have the interior minister, or you want to have the defense minister. An Italian defense minister from a communist party would have been a total nightmare for NATO, because within NATO they were circulating all NATO secrets, and they thought that the Italian communists would hand over these NATO secrets directly to Moscow. So this idea that the Italian population votes for somebody whom NATO doesn't want was really the problem during the Cold War. We didn't have full sovereignty. We had democracies, but the democracy was limited. You see that in the case of Aldo Moro, who was assassinated when he wanted to bring the Italian communists into the government. I mean, he was a high-ranking politician, but he was assassinated.
There were terrorist attacks in the 1980s, particularly in Italy. Can you give us an example of a couple of those which initially people thought were sponsored by the Soviet Union but actually turned out to be run by NATO?
The most famous attack is the one of 1972, which was carried out in Peteano. It was just a small attack with like two or five people who were lured to a car, and the car then exploded. There was a few policemen who were lured to the place by an anonymous phone call. This attack was first blamed on the Red Brigade. So there was an anonymous phone call and who said this attack had been carried out by the Red Brigades. And then everybody thought, okay, it was the left. And then 10 years later, an Italian judge, Felice Casson, investigated the attack again and found out that it had been a right-wing terrorist, Vincenzo Vinciguerra. So there we have the exact names. And the man, Vinciguerra, then confessed that he carried out the attack. And he said, yeah, but we were protected by NATO. They had a secret network. And everybody was saying, yeah, the man is just lying. You know, he's going to be crazy. But 10 years later, Italian Prime Minister Giulio Andreotti had to confirm that indeed there was a secret army named Gladio within the Italian military secret services. And then NATO had to take a stand. NATO first said, we don't want to comment. And then on the next day, they said, yes, there exists something like that, but we can't talk about it because it's a military secrecy. And still today, NATO does not want to talk about Gladio. I mean, most people know that NATO is involved in the war against Libya, but they have no clue about secret operations of NATO during the Cold War.
So what about this Operation Gladio, or Gladio, as he calls it? What is the extent of it, I asked him? And how on earth to penetrate the secrecy of NATO to actually find out who's organising this?
We know now that we had secret armies in Germany, in Belgium, in Italy, in Greece, in Turkey, in France, in Portugal, in Spain, in Norway, in Denmark. In all countries of Western Europe, we had these secret armies. That is a confirmed fact. The second thing which is confirmed is that these secret armies were linked to NATO and MI6, the British Secret Service, and CIA, the American Secret Service, and that they were trained by special forces, the SIS and the special forces of the US, the Green Berets. That is what we know, but we also know that in these countries we had terrorist attacks, but now to link the terrorist attacks in each country to the secret soldiers is very complicated, because we don't have written documentation from NATO which says, for instance, in Belgium we had a series of terrorist attacks, and we can prove we had terrorist attacks, but we don't know what the secret soldiers were linked. In fact, the Belgian Senate tried to investigate the links between the secret army, which existed in Belgium, that is confirmed, and the series of terrorist attacks which are called the Brabant massacres, which took place in the 1980s. And in Germany we had another terrorist attack in Munich in 1980, which was also supposedly linked to the secret network. But there again, you know, people died who wanted to make a statement, and it's very complicated. So it's still an ongoing investigation.
Why should NATO be blowing up bombs in Western Europe and blaming it on somebody else? I mean, most of us think of NATO as a military protection for members of the public in the West.
That's the way I thought of NATO as well in the beginning. I mean, at school, you know, in school I was told that NATO helps to protect democracies, and that you're on the other side of the Iron Curtain with the Warsaw Pact, and there we know they had no respect for human rights and civil rights and crushed down people and everything else. And we know all the details about that. But we know very little, in fact, about secret policies that were carried out in Western Europe during the Cold War. And when I researched for my book, it took me about 4 years, you know, I wrote to NATO and asked them about documentation. I wrote to the CIA and etc. It was part of my PhD at the London School of Economics. I was there, and I was in other countries, and it just turned out that NATO wouldn't want to talk about it. So all I learned was really from Italian generals who were directing these secret armies, and they explained that NATO, CIA and MI6 were concerned about the threat of a Soviet invasion. That was one purpose. And they were concerned about opposition within the countries that belong to NATO. And they used a strategy of tension, which basically means that you carry out a false flag terrorist attack and blame it on somebody else, blame it on your political opponent. Today that would be a Muslim jihadist Al-Qaeda thing. But back in the Cold War, the false flag obviously was blamed on communists. So people at the time had no chance to find out who was really behind the attack. And now, even with 30 or 40 years distance, for us as historians, it's very, very difficult to reconstruct the whole story.
Well, I then asked Daniela Ganser, the author of NATO's Secret Armies and Terrorism in Western Europe, about this whole thorny problem of impunity. Because many of the people that have been organising these terrorist attacks from NATO headquarters in Brussels over the decades are still working there.
The case of the Brabant massacres. The case was that in the 80s, you know, people went shopping in Belgium in the supermarkets, and then you had a group of people armed specially trained men, not, you know, not small robbers who hit you and then run away, but specially armed and specially trained men who came with their cars, stopped in front of the supermarkets, and shot down the people who were there shopping. They didn't even take much money. And you know, some people were running and crying, say, that's my child, and they just killed them, cold-blooded. And in some other instances, the police, who was alarmed and raced to the crime scene, they didn't run away from the police. They even waited for the police to come and shot them too. So they acted like special forces soldiers in a war. I mean, that's what soldiers do. They kill each other. But if you put this situation into a civilian world, like take Belgium, take people's supermarkets, take police office, then you suddenly find out there's something very wrong going on here. And when the Belgian Senate heard in 1990 that in Italy that you had the secret army linked to NATO, which was discovered, you had the Belgian defense minister, Guy Coëm, who flew back from Rome. He happened to be in Italy. So he flew back to Belgium and asked his chief of staff, do we have a secret army in Belgium too? I know nothing about it. And then his chief of staff, which is the highest ranking military in Belgium, said, yes, yes, we have such a secret army. And he said, why don't I know anything about it? And then he said, well, we need an investigation into this whole matter, and we need to find out whether our secret army was linked to these attacks on our population, you know, and whether NATO had anything to do with it. So the Belgian Senate set up a special group of parliamentarians who had to investigate this story. And the incredible thing is that the Secret Service in Belgium just refused to hand out the names. They just didn't give the names of the people who were involved in the secret army. And so researching state terrorism goes to a certain point where suddenly you stop and you don't get the final names and you don't get the courts to actually take over action, because killing people in democracy is just illegal, you know. It's, in the end, it's a question for the courts to handle. But there was nobody condemned for it. Nobody. We just didn't get the names.
Now, I know that the Belgian supermarket attacks happened at a very tense point between Europe and America, where the United States was very keen to have cruise missiles based in Europe, a little bit maybe like the modern-day missile defence shield in Eastern Europe is coming in. The Belgian government didn't want it. Now, after these supermarket attacks, the Belgian government immediately said, well, yes, it does look like there is a threat from the Soviet Union, we better have the cruise missiles.
You always have a political context that actually would favor destabilization. I mean, it's, if somebody looks from it from a distance, and I'm saying from a very immoral point of view, you can say it's very easy to take special forces, to take, you know, secret service operatives who are trained in military warfare and put them into a civilian context. I mean, how easy is that? People shopping, I mean, that's very easy to attack them. And then to cover up the traces is rather easy as well, if you have protection from higher levels. We have right-wing people involved in Belgium, for instance. The Westland New Post was a group of right-wing extremists, and they were involved. And they all said, you know, we checked out when the supermarkets were open, when they closed, and all these details, and whether they had protection or not. And then the journalists, the Belgian journalists who worked on this data, asked the people from the Westland New Post, did you actually carry out the attacks? And then they said, no, no, we didn't do it, but we have protection. We were always in contact with people from NATO and CIA and MI6. So it's always the same group popping up. And then in the end, if you ask CIA, I mean, I placed a freedom of information request with the CIA on Gladio and Stay Behind and NATO secret armies. And they just said, you know, we put you on a waiting list and give you an answer in due course. And that's like 8 years ago.
That was Danny Eleganser. I was speaking to him a couple of weeks ago, and he's the author of the book NATO's Secret Armies, and he's based in Switzerland, even though he did his initial research for his PhD here at the London School of Economics. Now, Martin Summers, the implication here, because we're looking at this in conjunction with the anniversary of the 7/7 London bombings, is that actually there is a track record of these kind of false flag attacks. Can you give us your take on this whole false flag business?
Well, I mean, I must say I've read Daniel's books, and I'm very familiar with the material he's talking about. There is obviously a question mark over Islamist terrorism when we have a context in which NATO has been involved in false flag terrorism in the past. And that's not conspiracy theory, as you so rightly pointed out at the beginning of this piece. This is all historically documented fact. Bologna railway station was blown up in 1980. I slept in the railway station a week before it was blown up. 86 people died. It was not carried out by the Red Brigades or the neo-fascists. It was carried out by the intelligence services and including MI6. Now, so MI6 have got a track record of blowing up innocent people in order to try and create political effects, and nobody has been punished. And are we surprised that some 50-odd people die on the London Underground on July the 7th? Now, it may be that the story is as the government says, and four random bombers with no mastermind got themselves together and blew themselves up just because they hated our freedoms or whatever the story is. But it's perfectly legitimate for us to ask, as I did ask it when I spoke at Birmingham Central Mosque a few years ago, is this a false flag attack? That's a perfectly legitimate question to ask. But it may or may not be, but it's an absolutely legitimate question.
Is there actually any evidence that it was a false flag attack, the 7/7 London bombings? Because one thing for certain is we still haven't had a proper public inquiry. The one that's just been announced today into phone hacking, we haven't had the same kind of level of judicial inquiry into the 7/7 London bombings.
Well, as you well know, Tony, it was investigators known to us that uncovered that the train the bombers supposedly caught, which is part of the narrative, they caught the 7 whatever it was from Luton to London.
This is the anonymous government narrative.
Yes, the anonymous government narrative. And through our checking, independent citizen journalist checking, we found that that train didn't run. So they claimed they had CCTV footage of the guys all the way, but they got the train time wrong. Now, how come? What sort of police investigation is it where you've not checked the most basic facts about which train they were or were not on? It suggests immediately that they already have a narrative, that we know he's done this, this is Al-Qaeda, this is the narrative, so we don't need to investigate, we know already. Now, this, of course, is very suspicious. When a bomb goes off, you can't presume you know who did it. It probably takes months to establish what might be the motives and who might have done it. But in most false flag attacks, there's an immediate explanation, and we're told, oh, yes, this is what's happening, it's the communists, it's the Islamists, it's whoever. And when you get an immediate kind of response like that, it should raise suspicions immediately, because in actual fact an investigation will take time to determine who's carried out an attack. If within 24 hours they're saying we know what happened, then immediately you smell a rat.
This idea of the false flag, excuse me, the false flag, isn't it something like to do with naval history?
Yes, to do with 18th century naval warfare. Captain Cockayne, who was the hero of Master and Commander, if people have seen that film, he was famous for his false flag attacks. So he would sail his ship right up to a Spanish or a French ship, flying a Spanish or a French flag, so they would think, oh, here's one of our ships. And then when he got right up close, he'd run up the Jolly Roger or the Butcher's Apron, the British flag, and then he'd open fire. And that was false flag attacks, as in naval warfare in the 18th century. But of course the concept has since evolved into what we're now talking about.
What might be the motives for the London bombings if it was a false flag attack? Is there an alternative motive?
Well, basically the Islamists had not done anything to the British people at all up to that point. I mean, 9/11 was supposedly carried out by the Islamists, although in fact it probably wasn't. But the British people basically were getting to the idea, well, you know, we've got nothing against the Muslims. I mean, why should we fight them? So we have to be given a reason to hate them. And that's what that would probably be about if it was a false flag attack.
Well, the day after the 6th anniversary of the 7/7 London bombings, we hear from a senior police intelligence analyst who believes the four alleged bombers didn't do it, and he was promptly sacked. So why does he think that? Who did do it, and how's his claim for unfair dismissal going? His name is Tony Farrell, and he worked for the South Yorkshire Police as a senior intelligence analyst. After much soul-searching, he decided the anonymously authored government version of events simply did not make sense, and told his bosses that the terror threat to Britain comes from something he calls the enemy within. I spoke to him earlier this week.
My name's Tony Farrell, and I used to work as a principal intelligence analyst for South Yorkshire Police. I'd been a long servant of the organisation. I joined the service in 1993 and had been a principal intelligence analyst since 1998. I'd also done a little bit of secondment work with the Home Office at the Government Office of Yorkshire and the Humber, working on the Crime Directorate. So I was head of profession for one of the largest police forces in the UK. And in September 2010, I was dismissed from that service as a principal intelligence analyst because of my beliefs. That's where I found myself out of a job. I was dismissed for a belief by the organisation.
Now, what was the belief that you held?
The belief was that it concerned a threat, and that was part of my assignment, to produce a threat assessment. The norm was to assume a threat assessment would cover a multitude of sins of criminality, ranging from antisocial behaviour to, say, terrorism. And it was on the issue of terrorism that the clash occurred. My beliefs on terrorism were such that I no longer believed that the major threat came from Islamic terrorism, but it came really from within. And one of the reasons why that was the case was I became disbelieving of the government narratives on 9/11 and, more importantly, perhaps in our country, our government narrative on 7/7. So I could not lie and go along with just the government narrative, believing that our government were telling lies themselves.
Now, that's a bit of a strong accusation to make, particularly because the three of the four alleged London bombers come from Yorkshire, don't they, where you were working?
Well, so I was working for South Yorkshire Police. Now, South Yorkshire Police covers Sheffield, Barnsley, Rotherham and Doncaster, whereas the police jurisdiction covering the alleged bombers was West Yorkshire Police, and in particular Leeds and, I think, Beeston.
So what was it that made you feel that, potentially anyway, that the three guys from Yorkshire that came down to London on the 7th of July 2005 and allegedly blew up tube trains, that the actual threat that day may have been from another source?
This became an emerging issue with me. It was shortly before this threat assessment that it dawned on me, and it dawned on me from open source information. So none of what I'm saying actually comes from police information systems. I had no reason to doubt the authenticity of the government's position on this, and the only reason why it came across on my radar was my home interests and my home research from open source information that any researcher out there in the wider world could actually have access to. So I want to say that first and foremost. But the reasons why I became deeply suspicious was when I watched a YouTube video, and it caused me great concern when it became clear that Peter Power was running the mock terror exercise on the very same day, whereby he is on record as saying the terror exercise was simulating the drill at the exact same locations and times as what actually occurred. And to my mind, that immediately aroused great suspicion. It's been downplayed. It is hugely significant, that, and the fact that that's never been investigated properly and brushed aside as just mere coincidence is deeply, deeply suspicious. And the odds of it being just coincidence alone without any connection is simply so remote as to make it virtually an impossibility. So that was the very first thing. But also, there was some interesting documentaries that were available on open source information on the YouTube, some compelling analysis that had been done, and we're talking things like 7/7 ripple effect, the big picture. These documentations were far more persuasive than the official version and the government versions that were available. So there was the unacceptably inept Home Office anonymous account that had holes in it and actually was proved to have already, you know, by their own admission, has contained lies. And we're talking in terms of the story regarding the train connection from Luton to the Thames link train into London, St Pancras. Well, that clearly, by admission later, was a lie, and it took researchers to actually reveal to them that that was the case. Other issues, Tony Blair, it was deeply suspicious that Tony Blair did not want an inquiry, and that occurred very quickly, within days, and Tony Blair, even on the day of the attacks, was on record as saying that this was being done in the name of Islam. And that was seen to me premature and run contrary to what the police were saying. So that, again, was deeply suspicious. The profile, the general profile that, of the alleged bombers seems far more consistent with them being set up as patsies rather than bombers. And then there's the reported incidents at Canary Wharf that seem to have been covered up and conveniently buried, yet they were announced and went across parts of the world, I think, in New Zealand. And quite frankly, the alternative hypothesis has been put forward seems to me far more likely, that actually at least one or two of those alleged bombers were taken out in Canary Wharf, and the fact that that seems to have just been brushed aside is deeply suspicious.
Do you think then that that there are systemic problems with the way the police analyse terrorism, that they're kind of in a bubble, and that some of this material from outside simply is not being considered by the police?
I have not been a special branch analyst, so I'm not privy to the detailed intelligence that, say, special branch analysts would have access to. What I can say is that, certainly with my treatment, I was tasked as an analyst to do a strategic threat assessment. So it was my analysis that they were wanting. When my analysis challenged the norm, and my analysis went outside the box in as much as didn't rely on simply information within the police, the databases, when I used open source information and challenged the police position by genuinely presenting my analysis and saying I could not present analysis that I think would be misleading, to actually be sacked for standing for what I believed as the analyst to be the truth, as opposed to be a misleading or a lie, there clearly is something wrong with the system that feels it necessary to sack an analyst for standing up for the truth and for actually offering. I offered to the police to produce a detailed report to justify exactly why I felt so confident in saying that I felt the government were lying on this and that there was a threat quite different from the strategic threat that they were articulating and wanting me to perpetuate all my faith, and my conscience simply wouldn't allow that to happen. So I think there is a problem. There is a problem with almost mind control here. You've got to go along with the narrative and you dare not challenge it. And if you challenge it, then your fate could be, in my instance, it's being dismissal. And that's just simply being for a belief and for standing up the truth. And the disappointing aspect is that that seems to run contrary to all the professional standards that the police have. And that means the police don't seem to be walking their talk, I'm afraid.
If the threat, as you say, is not so much from Islamic terrorism, where is the threat from?
I believe squarely that we've got a major issue here, and the threat is an internal one. The threat, I believe, comes from a new world order that actually has an ideology that is evil and wicked, that ultimately wants to bring about a fascist one world government and police state control. It's an ideology that I believe is a satanic ideology, where a common denominator on all of this is secret societies and many complex interlinking secret societies that are holding this together. And I'm afraid I think the examples of 9/11 and 7/7 are false flag operations and are examples of the New World Order in operation. And we have that, a New World Order in its ascendancy just at the moment. And that, to my mind, is a far bigger threat than Islamic terrorism.
That was Tony Farrell, former senior intelligence analyst at South Yorkshire Police, now fighting a case for unfair dismissal. Now, Martin Summers, can you just give us your take on what Tony had to say there?
Well, I think all of the stuff about 7/7 was very much to the point, because he's actually, you know, this guy's paid to analyse these events. He's analysed it correctly, in my view. I think he's jumping to conclusions about who was responsible, and if he says it's New World Order or satanic people or whatever, he means, he's just a conspiracy theorist, he just believes silliness. But of course, we've just had Daniel Ganser, who's an academic, pointing out that NATO goes around blowing things up. So it's hardly surprising if we presume that it might be the case in this case as well. Is it? They've got form.
Now, having reminded ourselves of the general pattern of these false flag attacks, let's hear an interview. This is carried out by Scott Horton with Dr. Merrill Nass, an anthrax expert. And this is from antiwar.com in 2010.
Next guest on the show today is Dr. Merrill Nass. Her websites are anthraxvaccine.org and anthraxvaccine.blogspot.com. And she knew, I don't know how well, Bruce Ivins, the dead but accused anthrax attacker. And she's written a heck of a lot of great stuff criticizing the FBI's case against Bruce Ivins. Welcome to the show, Dr. Nass. How are you doing?
Thank you. Doing fine.
I really appreciate you joining us on the show today. So first of all, can you just teach us the basics about anthrax? It's a spore, which means it ain't a virus and it ain't a bacteria. What's a spore? What's an anthrax?
Most spores are from fungi, but in this case, it is a bacterium, an odd bacteria that makes spores. Tetanus, by the way, is another one. Or the bacteria Clostridium tetani. So the bacteria, when it leaves your body, or when a person or animal dies that has anthrax and it is no longer in a positive environment, the bacteria forms a spore. And in the case of anthrax, that spore can last hundreds of years potentially. And it is impervious to changes of temperature and most changes of pressure. And in nature, lives in the soil.
Huh. So it actually does live, but it lives for that long and is impervious?
In suspended animation, basically.
Huh.
It's metabolically very inactive, but can still, you give it some water and food and the right temperature, and it will turn back into what's called a vegetative form.
Mm-hmm. All right, so why is it so useful as a weapon?
Well, it has a niche. It's not contagious person to person. So if an animal eats another animal that died of anthrax, they may get it. But you won't get it from any of your neighbors. So that it can be controlled. So if you wanted to, you know, drop it in one place and affect the people there and not have it spread without control, anthrax is a good thing to use. Although it generally takes, depending how much one inhales, if you were going to use it as in the airborne form, it could take anywhere from a day to weeks to become sick.
Hmm. All right, now, can you tell us how you knew Bruce Ivins?
I met Bruce Ivins 19 years ago at a conference when we happened to sit next to each other. And I have done some I've done some research in anthrax for 20 years. So we would keep in touch occasionally and meet at conferences. We were certainly not close, but we did know each other. We had a few letters and phone calls back and forth over, you know, about a dozen years.
Okay. And so you didn't know him that well personally, in the sense where you guys were kind of pals and talked about non-professional matters or anything like that?
No.
All right, so I guess, would it be useful for me to ask you whether you thought he was a crazy person or a murderer? Or could
well, he
be?
He never acted like a crazy person. He had a PhD. He was professional. He published a lot of papers. He was very competent at discussing science. He
but
was
not
actually
a mad scientist.
No, he was not a mad scientist. He was slightly awkward. You know, he was a little bit nerdy, but he was extremely kind, actually, which is why I think his friends are upset about this, better friends than I am, by the way, because he always was out there to try and help other people. For in my case, he would always give me articles that he thought were might be useful to the work I was doing. And he, you know, he played music at his church. He would write songs for people who were leaving work at the place where he worked, and whenever somebody new came to work in that lab or a nearby lab, he would assist them and really make himself available. So I guess for those reasons he was very warmly regarded.
Mm-hmm. Well, now it's interesting to me, although I'm not certain of the importance, but you seem to say on your blog here, Dr. Nass, again, that's anthraxvaccine.blogspot.com, that the FBI's report mischaracterizes your relationship with him. Is that right?
That's correct.
And how so?
Well, he and I had a very friendly relationship. You know, we would laugh together if we saw each other. The last time I saw him, I introduced him to my son, who was a juggler, and Bruce was also a juggler. So, I mean, we always had good times together. There was never a harsh word. There was never an unwillingness to answer a phone call. You know, we were professional friends. And when the FBI said that he was upset about me, I think that's nonsense.
Because you just know of no reason why he would be.
Well, what the FBI claimed is that I have very widely spoken and written about anthrax vaccine causing illness, and that he was very distressed by this and this threatened his job. The facts of the matter are that he agreed with me that anthrax vaccine probably caused illness. He knew he was actually working on newer vaccines that hopefully weren't going to cause illness, and his job was in no way threatened. So, you know, I'm guessing that the FBI chose to mention me in their report, along with two other people, probably because they didn't like my blogging on this subject and were trying to cast aspersions on my relationship with Bruce to make it appear that either I wasn't telling the truth in the blog, or that Bruce's other friends shouldn't talk to me, since we do talk, well, some of them do communicate with me regularly.
It seems to me like perhaps a simpler explanation would be that it was one of the things that they wanted to use to build the idea or the concept of his motive, that his job was threatened. That's what they said was his motive all along, right?
Right, but we knew his job wasn't threatened because he had a contract extending to, I think, 2005.
Hmm. All right, I want to get into this job threat. And, you know, I'm sorry that we only have 20 minutes, and I'm sorry that I'm so ignorant about this case. I've been, you know, trying to catch up with what's going on your blog here, and you just absolutely deconstruct almost every single thing that they say. Building their case is in question. Every premise that they build their argument on is just not right. Scientific, means, motive, opportunity, and the rest of it. So I guess let's start with the means. Can you talk to me about the silicone and the weaponization of the anthrax and the facilities at Fort Detrick and so forth? Or better, you start wherever you want. I want to go ahead.
Thank you. Well, I don't know about the specific facilities, and, you know, I think that's probably classified. But as I pointed out, there some people who knew Ivans have said there's no way he could have made this with the equipment available, and they have given their names. And there's other people who have not given their names who say they knew Ivans and they know the lab, and yes, he could have made it. Now, it seems to me that we can't show that either of those two are correct, although I tend to prefer people who use their names, because the FBI has never found a way to reverse engineer the anthrax. So if we don't know how it was made, we can't say whether he had the equipment available or not. But it's certainly everyone I've spoken with who have given their names has thought that his ability to make the amount of anthrax required in that lab within a week couldn't have done it in a week. Now, could he have done it over a longer period of time? Yeah, maybe he could have. Could he have done it without anybody noticing? Again, seems unlikely. This is a pretty high-powered government lab that is supposed to have a high level of security, and people are supposed to pay attention to what each other are doing. So I don't think he could have, but maybe he could have. Could he have added silicon to it? Well, initially, of course, the FBI denied that silicon had been added. Later, they admitted that there was silicon, but that it was all inside the spores and it was natural. It was some component of the water that was used to grow the anthrax. And for a long time, they wouldn't acknowledge how much silicon was in this, but eventually they said it was over 1% by weight. Well, of course, that does not occur naturally anywhere in this planet. And so somehow silicon was added to this preparation at some point. And
now, pardon me for my extreme ignorance here, but silicon different than silicone?
Silicon is an element, and silicone is a plastic substance that you can make breast implants and other
entirely different substances here.
Yeah.
Okay, pardon me. I
so
don't know anything about it.
Silicon is actually the element used to make glass, but it certainly can be a powder. Well, it turns out that silicon can be used to produce, you know, weaponized spores. And it was probably deliberately added so that to make the spores disperse better. FBI has never said they found any silicon in the lab, which would suggest, it's an element, right? It's part of the Earth's crust. It's at the beach. It's everywhere. But whether they found any powder in the lab that he would have had to have left some behind if he had put it into the growth mixture, that they haven't found, or they haven't admitted they found it. And there was also a bacillus contaminant, called Bacillus subtilis, a similar bacteria to anthrax, but not exactly the same, which was present in the early letters. And the FBI has never found that contaminant at the Fort Detrick lab. So without being able to show that these components of the anthrax were there, I don't think they can make a case that, Bruce produced the anthrax that was in the anthrax letters at his lab.
Now, there was this thing in the Wall Street Journal that said, basically, I think pretty much what you just said about they haven't been able to recreate a situation where the anthrax would somehow naturally incorporate
right.
all this silicone
right.
into it, and I forget all the percentages yeah. and so forth. But then there was this thing by Dan Vergano in the USA Today saying, oh, come on, you people are just ignoring all the evidence that has come forward saying that, you know, that basically debunks those Wall Street Journal accusations or interpretations. Have you seen that?
I haven't seen that piece. I think what's important is that the FBI seems to have deliberately misrepresented the evidence in a lot of places. So not only in terms of my relationship with Ivins or whether his job was in jeopardy, but they seem to have had a series of different stories about the silicon, about his movements, whether it was unusual for him to work in the lab at night, or they said it was very unusual, but he worked late in the lab the 2 weeks before each set of letters were mailed. And yet again, his colleagues say he worked late all the time. There are just numerous, probably at least 10 or 15 different mischaracterizations, misrepresentations, or outright lies that are in the FBI report. And that's a problem. The way the FBI pursued this case is another problem. There were a number of initially there were, of course, probably hundreds of suspects. But the FBI was really not interested in Stephen Hatfill until Congress got interested in him, and then they pursued him with great vigor. And eventually he won a settlement for $5.8 million. He was never arrested. But his career was ruined.
Well, and there's some indication that he was set up, right? I mean, the letters had they were what, the Greendale or the Greenville School, something like that, which
yes.
was right near where he had worked in South Africa.
Yes, in Zimbabwe, it was
in
right
Zimbabwe.
Near his medical school. One hoax letter was mailed from England when he was in England. And there were other ways in which it seems he may have been set up. Also, he was sort of the perfect patsy in that he had a history of being a right-wing sort of neo-Nazi person who had been a bodyguard of Eugene Terblanche, who was a well-known white supremacist in South Africa. He had claimed to work with the Sella Scouts, who were a sort of notorious group that sometimes actually would get black guerrillas and turn them and then send them back to... They were responsible for most of the deaths of black people during the Zimbabwe War. He claimed to do other things that made it easy for him to be disliked and made it easy to point the finger at him. Because, for instance, on his curriculum vitae, his resume, he claimed to have adeptness with weaponized dried anthrax. So if you were looking for a patsy, he was the perfect patsy.
Well, now, I want to get back to, I want to ask you about the mysterious letter that was sent. It's been a long time, and there's a timeline mm-hmm. here that I think shows that this letter came between two different anthrax letter mailings.
Is this the letter blaming Dr. Assad?
Right, exactly.
Yes, that was interesting. A letter came to the FBI at Quantico, Virginia, claiming that a former virologist at Fort Detrick was a terrorist. And this letter was mailed after the first set of anthrax letters were mailed, but was actually opened and read before any of the anthrax letters had been identified. And Assad had been treated very badly, allegedly treated very badly by colleagues at Fort Detrick because he was from a Muslim country. I think he might have been from Egypt. And they wrote poems about him. They passed around a plastic camel that everyone would joke about. And he wound up suing Fort Detrick. So here's this guy that hasn't even worked there in years, and suddenly a letter comes alleging that he's a terrorist. Right, and I think it may, there's something else about that letter that may be, that links it to the case. But interestingly.
Well, there was something about, they said it was written by a female, because of the handwriting, and that there were at least indications of who it was, the specific woman at Fort Detrick that he had the problem with, something like that.
Well, I'm not sure about that. Certainly the writer seemed to know intimate details about Assad. But what was interesting was the FBI wouldn't give him a copy. They may not have even let him look at the letter. They read it to him. And they didn't let Donald Foster, who was doing the initial work on the anthrax letters as a sort of linguist, a forensic linguist isn't the right word. He worked with writing to try to identify who wrote documents. And he had done a number of cases with the FBI, and he had identified the author of a book, maybe more than one book. So he was given the original anthrax letters, but the FBI would not give him this letter implicating Assad. In any event,
right,
it looked like somebody might be trying to set up Assad also as a patsy. And then there were other people the FBI had gone after. And at the time Bruce Ivins committed suicide, there were actually other people at Fort Detrick who were also under close surveillance by the FBI. So they hadn't actually narrowed it down to Bruce.
Yeah, I mean, it really does look like after they successfully hounded him into killing himself, that someone in the Department of Justice or the FBI just said, all right, that's it. Build a case that this was our guy and we're going to close this thing.
Because exactly.
Everything about this, I mean, just to read whatever's on the front page of your blog this morning is enough to make you see how basically all the evidence is kind of constructed after the fact to fit. Like they say, you know, him working late, that doesn't mean anything unless you're trying to prove that Ivins is the one. Then you go, look, Ivins was working late or whatever. And of course, we had George Matschke from antipolygraph.org on the show a couple of weeks ago, talked about how they say that when they look at his polygraph, that they can tell that he used classic countermeasures to defeat them and pass the polygraph test. And obviously, there are classic countermeasures, but there are no ways to look at a polygraph result that you twice said he passed with flying colors years ago, and then go back and look at it and say, oh, look, here's where the classic
exactly.
countermeasures were kicked in. That's completely fictional and complete, you know, and it goes on and on like that, right? This whole thing
Correct.
Is built after the fact to try to prove the case.
Yes.
And it's blatant. It really is blatant. But let me ask you this, because I think here's... Presumably, this could be, you know, the toughest part of your argument here is this is that USA Today, and I'm sorry you haven't,
mm-hmm.
I didn't send it to you before the show to look at or anything, but this USA Today article is called Anthrax Myth Persists Despite Evidence. And he's quoting a researcher at Sandia National Laboratory named Joseph Michael,
mm-hmm.
saying, one of my biggest frustrations with this has been showing people the data and it doesn't matter. And he says he's presented his electron microscope results that show that the 2001 anthrax attack wasn't weaponized for 2 years. But still the idea refuses to go away, he says. And then apparently he looked at an electron microscope and the silicon in it, the content, and he decided that it wasn't a suspicious big deal at all or something.
Right. Well, you know, most people in the know would disagree with him. That's all I can say. Anthrax nowhere else is what is made of silicon 1.4%. What he's referring to is that it wasn't put on the outside of the spores. It was actually incorporated into the spore coat. Well, that's interesting, but that doesn't mean it wasn't weaponized, because when you grow anthrax normally, silicon is not incorporated into the spore coat because you just don't have that much of it in the medium. And
well,
Joe Michael has, by the way,
Sandia.
He is a consultant for the FBI. He's done a lot of work for the FBI, and I would say that he has confused this issue on several prior occasions.
Well, I mean, they say he's with Sandia Laboratory. Is that the same guy you're saying is a consultant for the FBI?
Yes.
But then there have been other tests at Sandia. I thought they were the same ones who were unable to reverse engineer this stuff, right?
Correct.
Uh-huh.